You're listening to a Mutiny Transmission.
You can find more podcasts, videos, books, comics, and records online at mutinyinfocafe.com.
Or just stop in the store in Denver and have a coffee sometime.
Making up the stories, making up our dreams. Queen City of the High Plains, we're lovers of the scene. Now I'm in love.
Hey everyone, thank you for coming to Queen City Companion. Give yourselves a hand for being, you're already doing it. Cool. Intuitive. I like it. My name is Brian Flynn. I am one of the co-hosts of this show. It's one of my favorite shows to see every month. I'm so lucky to be involved in it. Queen City Companion is an all-fall storytelling show. We have storytellers from all different backgrounds. I do stand-up. What you're going to hear from me tonight is not that, which is very nerve-wracking for me personally, and I appreciate your understanding. But this show is about getting people to try new things, whether it's comedians doing actual serious writing or writers being able to share in a public space. So with that said, I'm going to get us started. So the thing I'm going to be doing is actually a little different. I started reading this piece a few months ago here. It's a science fiction story, and I'm going to be reading sort of a portion of the middle section for it. So I'm serializing it. It's exactly like Dickens, in every single way. So just to get everyone caught up, there's a story called Imminence. The main character, Kim, she is a reporter with the San Francisco Chronicle. And in the scene right before this, she believes she has uncovered evidence that one of the city's tech giants, sort of a loose Elon Musk figure, I can say that now that everyone agrees that he's a piece of crap, is responsible for a murder using a self-driving car. So that is what happened right before we get to this portion of the story. It's past nine, and the fluorescent lights of the Chronicle office only highlight the dark in the windows. Still, a few heads peek out from the warren of desks. I walk the length of the office. I can feel the faces turn to follow me. I reach my desk and I'm thankful to be in the corner where I can see anyone stepping off the elevator. The whir of my booting computer sounds to me like a bathtub filling with water. I reach in my bag and pull out my notes, and when I look up, Mark is sitting on the desk opposite me. "Don't do that," I sigh. "Sorry." Mark's never in the office after six. "What are you doing here?" "Covering for one of the night editors. What do you have for me?" Mark is a good editor, but I can't remember him offering to cover for anyone in 9 years. "Just get him off your back until you get it written." "It's nothing. Leak of new features for Orchard's next-gen phone." "Then why am I getting phone calls from Rayden Madsen accusing you of harassing him at his home half an hour ago?" I look out to the office and see eyes turning away from us. It's always too quiet in here at night. I drag Mark into his office and shut the door. "Have you lost your mind? Madsen killed Rebecca Wall." "Slow down. Rebecca Wall's master's thesis was a proof of concept for a neural networking implant, which worked by putting the wearer to sleep, allowing the other users to override their motor and speech functions. Madsen reviewed her work." "Okay, the Lucid implants, stolen from Rebecca Wall's work. 3 days after Madsen unveils Lucid, Rebecca Wall consults an intellectual property lawyer named Hogan Marshall, who, poor girl doesn't know, Rain Labs has kept on retainer for 6 years. Rain Labs has an in-house legal team. Madsen wouldn't retain an outside lawyer. Unless it's to cover payments to that lawyer. Advance notice of lawsuits, patent filings. He's probably paying off all the intellectual property lawyers in California." "Okay, so maybe. Maybe you have intellectual property theft. You certainly don't have murder. Madsen gave me the murder. He just doesn't know it yet. And I have a source at SFPD. On the record, they have to cover themselves. Mark rubs his eyes with his palms. Kim, we need to be very careful about how we proceed. Rain Madsen stole Rebecca Wall's work and then killed her. If they see this in the morning meeting before I have a chance to tell them about it, the ME will have my ass. Who gives a shit about your ass? Or mine? He has my stories about him plastered all over his wall. We built his whole image for him, and we're responsible for correcting it. You will sit on the story, okay? Please go home, Kim. From Mark's desk, the phone rings. The echo buzzes in the silence of the office. I yank on the receiver as the second ring starts. Kilgariff, newsroom. I deadpan, staring directly at Mark. He can't even bring himself to look at me. On the other end of the line, there is a sharp inhale and surprised silence. My fingertips dig into my palm. God damn it, I know you're there! Rain Madsen's voice vibrates in my ear. Kim, I think you're getting a little out of hand. I peel the receiver away from my cheek and hold it out for Mark. It's for you. He grabs it away from me. Give me a minute, sir. I'm already turning away when he says it. I hear Mark slam the phone down. I storm to my desk and grab my stuff. I begin texting George's name when I hear Mark huffing behind me. Kim, stop this. His dry hands grab my wrist and my phone falls onto the tile with a heavy crack. I twist against his thumb and pull my arm free. You, don't fucking touch me. Panic glares through Mark's wide eyes. We both turn out to the newsroom, see people leaning out, trying to get closer, trying to know what's going on. They can all see you, Mark. Kim, I push past him with my bag and head to the stairway. Eyes follow me all the way. The server at Pinecrest Diner now just assumes I want a refill on my coffee. He stopped asking 3 hours ago. He made me order solid food before he would let me plug my laptop in behind the counter. I type out an email to Detective Knorr's personal account. I tell her everything that happened with Madsen, everything at the office. I tell her I don't feel safe meeting at my house. The need to be in public sparking through my body. I tell her about the car I thought was following me up Market, but that disappeared when I turned onto Geary. I tell her I parked a block away from the diner and walked with my hood up. Tell her I wasn't followed. 2 minutes later, I get a reply, on my way. That was 2 hours ago. I know it's getting late because the fog has blown in like it always does. I go over all the details again. I make sure everything is tight. Half my contacts will be seeing the story from the Times to wire to the San Jose Mercury. The bell chimes over the opening door. A homeless man walks over to the counter and hands a thermos to the server who fills it with coffee. I don't realize how hard I'm staring at him until he looks at me. He smiles a tight smile and walks away, and I notice my hand is shaking. I don't know if it's the coffee. I pick up Rebecca's photo from next to my computer and look into her eyes. Then I begin to steady myself. The server slides a plate of hash under my face. I look up to thank him and see a car pull into the parking space outside the window, smooth and perfect. A black Rain Model S, with its dashboard camera pointed directly in the window. The headlights fill the diner and fall over me, find me shaking again. When the lights switch off, I can see the driver's seat. The car is empty. What does it feel like to get hit by a car? I can feel the weight of it. It's not the pain, it's the heaviness. He wants to pin me down to the earth. He wants to roll over me. I think about the camera. I think about him watching through a screen and far away. Rage swells my face when I picture him being able to watch. You found me. I look in Rebecca Wall's eyes and back at the empty car. But I found you first. I carry my laptop to the window. I turn the screen to face his camera. I click send and a large gold box flashes onto the screen. For the first time I can remember, I breathe. Now if something happens to me, everyone will know why. I walk back to the counter and eat my breakfast. The server doesn't ask any questions about what he just saw, so I tip him extra. I leave as the eastern sky is turning red. I walk down the street slowly with my hood down. I feel the headlights climbing up my back. In the dawn light, they're pale, and I make my way through the fog. Okay, so that's what that is. Wild, wild tone shift. Thank you. I'm so excited. Are you ready to get the show started? Yeah. Your first performer, stand-up comic, who is helping to put together a comedy show October 12th at STEM Ciders with an all-female lineup, and all the proceeds go to benefit Planned Parenthood. So go check that out. That's October 12th at STEM Ciders. Ladies and gentlemen, Josue Flores.
Thanks, everybody. Got invited to come do this last minute. I do comedy. I am pretty bad, I'm sure. But I also like to write as well, and this is the first time me writing. Me reading something I wrote, and I was told that it should be something that's fiction. Most of the stuff that I've written up to this point is not fiction, really. It's kind of based off of experiences and memories. So this is the only thing I've ever written that's a fictional story, and it's pretty short, and it's about hate, so yeah, that's fun. Let's get started. Tyler's story is Hermano. It's also written like a script, so I don't, yeah, okay. Ren is sitting in her living room folding laundry while her son is being a child in the kitchen at the back of the house. There's a knock on the door, and a dog starts barking, pawing at the glass at the top half of the door while Ren gets up to answer. Pocatello says, "Hey, Ren, how's it going?" Ren replies, "Oh, hey, Josue. What's up?" Pocatello responds, "Oh, you know, I was just in the area, wanted to stop by and give you a ring." Ren is confused and clearly uncomfortable by the unannounced visit. Ren responds, "So can I get you anything?" Pocatello says, "Yes, I would like some tea, green, or whatever you have." She walks off as he makes himself comfortable in her home. He stares at a picture with her dead husband and their child, who was an infant at the time. Pocatello, shouting from the other room, says, "So how's the boy doing? Is he 11 or 12 now?" Ren shouts from the kitchen, "He's 11. You were just at his birthday. I guess you weren't as sober." Ren comes back with the tea, looking concerned, and sits with distance on the couch while Pocatello moves his gloves over on the table. Ren asks, "So why the impromptu visit?" Pocatello then replies, "Oh, well, you know, I heard one of my people, it was freezing out, and you told them to go home, but they were supposed to stay until relief came to stand guard. And, well, I just don't understand why you would do that." Ren, holding her tea in her hand, "Well, it was so cold, so..." Pocatello coolly replies, "Yes, but that's their fucking job. If I tell them to lay on the porch with their ass out, they fucking do it. You feel me?" Ren responds, "Okay, well, I just thought given." Pocatello says, "Why would you do that? You know they come around mostly at night. What if they would have come again after you told them to leave? What would have happened? Another dead mother and baby hanging from the tree of the front of their lawn?" Ren says, shaking, "It's just that it doesn't make me feel safe, and the guns they have. Chavi just stares, and I don't like it." Pocatello replies, "Yeah, I don't like fucking Nazis that killed my brother when they showed up to his house because they're following some dictator that made himself king. But now we all have guns, and that's the new reality." Ran quietly, "Pocatello, please stop yelling. You're being very aggressive, and I don't like it. I don't like that you think..." Pocatello interrupts, "What, Ren? I think what?" His eye starts twitching as he clenches his jaw. Ren says to him, "That you act like this is your house and that we're your family when we're not your family. Chavi isn't your son." Pocatello, now red in the face, "Who tells the guards to bring your bread and milk? Who's following the orders from the commander? Who pays off the bureaucrats downtown and leave you and Chavi's names off the monthly census? Now you're not my family? You're my brother's family, but you are my fucking responsibility, so don't give me that shit." The dog starts barking, and Ren stares off at her coffee in her lap. Ren, shaking, "I heard about that militia man hanging from the tree in Fryman Square facing Anthony Wayne's statue. He was Chavi's age." Pocatello coldly, "And why does that matter? He was a fucking Nazi. We kill Nazis or they kill us. That's a good thing that he got the life choked out of him before he became more of a threat." Ren starts crying. Ren, full of emotion, "I don't like it. I don't like any of it." Hands clenched by her face. "None of it makes me feel good. And he wouldn't have liked it either. What's the point of all this shit? Just let it go, please." Pocatello staring at nothing. You know, I strangled a boy younger than that, younger than Xavi, saw him turn purple and his nose start bleeding. Just another dead Nazi. Didn't even get to do the ritual where he has to look at a white supremacist statue as he dies. Screams. Pocatello with no emotion. I have to protect my brother's family, and you have to help me do that. So please, for the love of God, do not tell him to leave when I'm protecting the house while he's crying. Please, Ren. Ren resigns with her head in her lap. Pocatello looks up and over the foray into the kitchen, sniffling as his mood picks up. Oh, Xavi, how long have you been standing there, Ijo? That's the end.
One more time for Josue Flores, everyone. Hell yeah. Your next performer is my co-host and co-producer of this show. She also co-hosts Mutiny Book Club, which is a monthly book club. It's also a podcast recorded here the last Sunday of every month. The next book is The Death of Truth, right? Please welcome the wonderful, wonderful Jen Kolick, everyone.
Hey, guys. I'm on the board of the Colorado Independent Publishers Association this year, so if you want a free pass to our next meeting on Saturday the 15th, get at me, because it's awesome. So this story is something that I've been working on for a couple of months. I actually talked about it on the last book club podcast, all the stuff that I've been doing for research. I feel like I should do a Russian accent for this, but I don't want to because it would make poor Katie cry, because it would be terrible. Let's get into it. How about a round of applause for Death and Destruction tonight, by the way, before we get started on this? Yeah, okay. Cool. Okay. September 15th, 1941. If you leave without an evacuation order, you are a deserter. If you stay despite one, you're waiting to welcome the fascists. That's what the party says. I've been through 3 wars, 2 famines. I buried my husband here. I'm not going anywhere. The Admiralty spire still stands, and the Neva is nearly frozen already. Let them come. We will paint the snow with their blood. September 21st, 1941. Air raid last night. Down in the stairwell with the rest of the building, those of us that are left. Grigory Punin, the factory director. He had to stay, but he got his wife a position as a governess for the factory kindergarten, which was evacuated to Moscow. But if the rumors are true, Moscow may not fare much better. Yelena Akhmatova, the landlady, kept up a patter of idiocy the whole time. Comrade Stalin defending the motherland, all that rot. Lydia Bogdanova, the widow from downstairs, locked her eyes to mine and smirked. We nodded along, hypnotized by the rhythm of Yelena's voice and the pounding of the shells. Afterward, on the landing, Lydia winked at me. Good night, sister. September 30th, 1941. When Molotov first announced the invasion, there was a run on the banks. I didn't bother. I knew they would run out. I went straight to the shops and spent all the cash from the cupboard on sardines, tea, millet, oil, anything that would keep. I took my wedding ring and Alexei's watch and hid them. Lydia did the same. The city's food stores were bombed 3 weeks ago. People are getting desperate. Lydia's husband was a party member until he was shot for a traitor last year. Her only son shipped off to the gulag. She takes insane risks since then. If they're going to come for me, they're going to come. I might as well do what I want. Does she trust me not to inform on her, or does she truly not care? I'm just happy to have someone to talk to. I gave her some tea and got some extra candles in return. October 6th, 1941. The news from the loudspeakers is always the same. The situation is complex. Our brave soldiers defending the motherland. But word gets around. Someone's cousin's fiancé has written from the front that the Germans are advancing fast, and the Finns with them. Grigory, the factory director, says no supplies are coming in anymore. Their railroad lines have all been cut. They're relying on scavengers to bring in material. He doesn't want to let any of his workers go because their rations will be cut. October 10th, 1941. Whatever Sovinform admits to, the truth is 10 times worse. If they say our soldiers are defending Pushkin from fascist attack, it means the town's already been taken and probably burned to the ground. There are whispers of the Nazis as liberators. I hear the murmurs, waiting in line for flour. They cannot possibly be worse than the Bolsheviks. But I don't believe it. They are invaders. Let them shoot me. I will die before I surrender. Lydia doesn't want to take sides yet. Who knows, she says. They've already killed my Pyotr and taken my boy. What could be worse than that? I am rationing myself. A pot of tea for breakfast with only one tea bag. Thin kasha for lunch. Lydia brings potatoes or lentils for dinner and I share my sardines. If we are together in the evening, we burn less wood. The Germans will not last the winter, but the winter is long. October 25th, 1941. They've started dropping leaflets over the city. There can be no more doubt. Crude, vulgar slogans of rabid violence. Grigory's cousin snuck into the city, walking all night from Pushkin. It was even worse than we thought. Germans rounded up all the party members and Jews, demanding they register. Everyone who showed up was shot. The soldiers went house to house, killing anyone who tried to hide. They hung children from the trees, the cousin said. Even the Bolsheviks never did that. The Reich will last 1,000 years, the leaflets say. They will save us from impurity. Barbaric. Those who would save themselves have fled long ago to Moscow or their run-down dachas. The true Leningraders remain. We are Russian to our bones, and we will never surrender to such monstrosity. Lydia brought over the last of her firewood tonight. We will have to scavenge now, or else burn the furniture. It is no matter. I have always hated this sideboard. A wedding gift from Alexei's parents. His mother was a formidable woman and smart, but her taste in furniture was execrable. They are fortunate not to have lived. Yelena traded dogs with a family across the street. She couldn't bear to kill her own. Can you imagine, I said, my hand over my mouth, eating the family pet? Lydia blew smoke out of her nostrils and shrugged. If Dmitri's damned cat hadn't run off after he was sent away, I would have traded it for more tobacco. November 6th, 1941. I was up late last night, in the dark, thinking about the months to come. What will become of us? The bodies are already piling up in the streets, thin and stiff as kindling. Children drag their parents' bodies on sledges, looking for someone who will bury them, but there is no one. The ground is frozen and impenetrable, and there is no one to help anyway. They're all starving. Grigory gets extra rations as factory director, as do the workers, but most of their bread is still sawdust. So the bodies stay above ground, stacked on the banks of the Neva. If it was summer, the smell would be overwhelming by now, but it is freezing, and so the bodies freeze. Just after sundown, a group of men came to strip the new ones before they became too stiff. They took boots and coats, whether for themselves or to trade for food. Some were already in rags. Some bodies, when the men left, were left naked. I made a pot of weak tea. I shouldn't have, but I was not ready to sleep and needed something to keep warm. I was just finishing my second cup when I saw it. A man, very tall, all in black, walking fast along the banks. The streetlights had been out for weeks, but the moon shone brightly enough to see. His shadow was long and thin as a blade. He went straight for the corpses. As he ran, he crouched, as if trying to avoid detection. But there was no one to see. My window was dark. It was impossible that he had noticed me. His hands connected with the ground, and as I watched, his back arched and his coattails thinned and stood up. Where the man had strode just moments before, now there was an enormous black dog running full tilt at the mound of bodies. The dog leapt on the pile and buried its muzzle in the frozen flesh. For several minutes, the dog tore at the bodies, moving from one to another, ripping through cloth and tearing at entrails. I could hear the tearing even from my window upstairs. Maybe that was my imagination. When the beast was satisfied, it clambered down to the riverside, hidden from sight. But moments later, the tall man strode back out to the sidewalk. He stooped to dip a handkerchief in the snow, and then walked off briskly, shoulders straight, wiping his hands and face. God help us. Leningrad may yet fall to the Germans. It doesn't matter. if what I saw last night was real, our very souls will perish. Thanks, guys.
Jen Kolick, everyone, one more time for her. Death and Destruction. Woo. Your next performer, we're so lucky to have had her before. She's a returning favorite. Please, please give a warm welcome to Katie Cotham-Butel.
Wow, who'd have thought I'd be comic relief? So before I start, I feel like I should say this. I was talking to these two Russian guys one time, and you know a couple years ago how Russia stole back the Crimea from Ukraine? Well, it was Russia's to begin with. Long story short, they're sitting there joking, and they're like, yeah, these Americans, what, should we say we stole back the Crimea? First of all, I have to tell you, the Russian word for Crimea is Krim. So they said, so now what? Are we going to steal Alaska back? We'll call it ice cream. Anyway, so, ba-dum-bum, yeah. I have for you tonight two truths and a lie, and it's up to you to decide which one is which. So, story number one. My mom grew up on a farm in the Midwest. They were basically poor white trash, but probably had a way happier childhood because of it. I mean, who doesn't enjoy running behind the machinery as they spray DDT on the fields? Or playing in floodwater in the ditch? They had all kinds of adventures, and much of their fun centered around the many pets that they had. Apart from the dogs, cow, chickens, and mean old rooster, they had several pet raccoons. Raccoons make great pets until they hit puberty, and then they turn into surly teenagers just like humans. One of the raccoons was slightly addicted to magic markers. Now, keep in mind that this was in the early 60s before all this non-toxic shit came out. Those motherfuckers would mess you up. So this raccoon got a hold of one of these markers, pulled the felt out, and laid there getting high. My uncle woke up the next morning to find black paw prints all over his bed and face. But probably the best story was when at a family dinner one Sunday evening, my great-grandmother looked over to see the raccoon standing there, smiling his big old toothy grin with her false teeth in his mouth. Story number two. Another great animal story involved a stinky intruder. Living in the middle of the fields, you tend to get a lot of wild animals visiting. On this particular occasion, a skunk managed to sneak into the house when the screen door didn't quite get closed. Mr. Skunk was peacefully snooping in the kitchen, sniffing around, when suddenly he was discovered by the dog. A high-speed and noxious chase ensued. The chase started with the Boston Terrier confronting the skunk, who then decided to show the dog that he was not, in fact, afraid. The skunk took off after the dog, running all around the living room and dining room, and ended when the dog cornered the skunk. Seeing no way out of the situation, the skunk turned around and took aim, spraying the dog and the entire living room. Fortunately, no humans were in the house at the time. However, when they returned to find a house that looked like a tornado had blown through, smelled like the most putrid thing you could never imagine, and a whimpering dog whose eyes had swelled shut, they were all in shock. They grabbed a few things, headed to Grandma's house, where she promptly stripped them all, made them bathe, bathed the dog in tomato juice, and called the fumigator. And story number three. I know you're all thinking, how can this get any better? But I've done a fair amount of traveling in my life, and sometimes you have to get a little creative. When you're in a foreign country and you have very little money or idea of what is going on, you learn to make shit up. I was an exchange student in one of the former Soviet countries and took a bus trip to Prague with my friend and host sister. The trip was a week long, but we had to get new visas to return to the country where we were living because we only had one entry visas. We ended up staying and doing the trip a second week because it was cheaper than paying for an expedited visa. So over the weekend, my friend Sarah and I, granted we were 17 and 18 year olds at this point, were on our own, footloose and fancy free in Prague. There were these two guys who had been on our original trip, and they stayed over too, one of whom looked exactly like Jean-Claude Van Damme and was just as big of an asshole. He also kept trying to separate Sarah from me all the time, which really pissed me off. We hung out with them. They tried to get us to go to a strip club with them. We had drinks in their room one night. Basically, we did all those things that like our mothers would die if they knew. But the one thing that I remember most was cooking in our hotel room. So we couldn't really afford to eat out all the time, but our hotel room didn't have a kitchen. It's a good thing, yeah. We bought mugs, and we had one of those little coil heaters that you put like in a mug of water and you plug it in and it heats the water. And then when we went to the store, we found a shit ton of these cup of soup packets and all different flavors. And we were like, yes, we can eat. But believe it or not, we eventually got tired of cups of soup. And we were like, there's spaghetti. I really want to make some fucking spaghetti. So we were standing in our hotel room and we're looking around thinking, now how the fuck are we going to cook this spaghetti? When we spot it, a plastic flower pot. Was it a good idea? Probably not, but it seemed fucking brilliant at the moment. So we put the coil heater in the water with the spaghetti and managed to cook it. We only melted the edge of the flower pot slightly. The next night, however, we overindulged in alcohol and I got really sick. I threw up everywhere, including in the plastic flower pot. The following day, when we wanted to cook more pasta, we looked at the plastic flower pot. No. Mm-mm. So we did what anyone would do. We went in the hallway and traded it for a different one.
Yeah. I was thinking both the raccoon and skunk were false.
Nope.
Because it's so unusual for a skunk to go after.
The skunk was based on truth, but not.
Also, sorry for celebrating like that. I think that's a 15-yard penalty. Katie Cothenbuettel, everyone. One more time for her. Bryce Maiero, who runs Punch Drunk Press, who helped us produce this show, introduced Jen and I to your next performer, and we are so excited to see what he has to offer. Please, please give a warm welcome to O'Brien Gunn.
Hello. So I'm going to be reading the opening to my first novel, which is coming out next year. It's called Thus Spoke. It's being published by Spaceboy Books. And it's a combination of a graphic novel Watchmen and what the TV show Heroes could have been. So here we go. The younger man sits leaning forward with his elbows on his knees. He starts to reach for the glass of water on the living room table. Drops his hand and rubs it on his thigh. A palm rests on his shoulder. He looks to his left at the older man who looks like him. What is it, DJ? Wrinkles deepen around the older man's eyes as he twitches his brows together. It's just the two of us here. You can tell me. DJ parts his lips and starts to speak, but rolls his lips under his teeth and bites down instead. Son, how long have I been telling you you can tell me anything? DJ blinks, lifts his chin. Are you gay? Head shake. Is it Is it related to sex? Head shake. Well, I can't sit here and guess all. I'm an Alpha Omega. The words tremble from DJ's mouth and his hands quiver. DJ's father doesn't move for a moment. He slowly removes his hand from his son's shoulder and rubs it across his thigh as the muscles in his forehead twitch. I'm sorry, Dad. The words are whispered. His father's fingers curl into a loose fist as a weight of implication bows him forward over his knees. Does your mother know? He sees his son nod out of a corner of his eye as he stares at the wall of family pictures behind the love seat across from them. What does Eugene do to you? He speaks from behind the wall of his hand. The washer clicks to a stop in the laundry room down the hall, releasing a buzz in the sudden layer of silence. DJ swallows before he speaks. I can see emotions there. He swallows a lump in his throat. It's like seeing colored smoke around a person. I don't know how I know what the different colors mean. His shoulders shake slightly as he shrugs. I just do. His father grunts and scrapes fingertips across his forehead. DJ looks over at his father, the motion made with utmost care, as if the man will shatter if he turns too quickly or looks too hard. I'm sorry. Okay. His father stands. Need a second to process this. He stalks down the hallway deeper into the house. DJ looks after his father and as he leaves, resting his elbow on the armrest and flicking his thumb against his lips as he looks out of the window. He shakes his head and exhales a trembling breath. The truth released from his tongue feels like a fuse burning down to a domestic detonation. He wonders how bad the fallout will be, or maybe it won't be as tragic as footsteps sound from down the hall. DJ lifts his head and sees his father coming toward him with a gun down in his thigh. He stops flicking his gun against his lips, stops breathing, hears a distant hiss of the fuse. His father's mouth is twisted as it twists to one side. DJ starts to speak, but stops when his father glares at him and inhales deep through his nose. Why me, Why are you talking to me and my family? He stops on the other side of the table. My life's not shot full enough ragged holes. Now I got demons or aliens or whatever the hell you Alpha Omegas are snatching my son up and replacing him with a clone. The gun lifts a few inches in his hand. He drops it when he realizes what he's doing. I didn't do this on purpose. DJ feels a hollow ache in his chest moments before the tears start to fall, lips pinching to the side. What did you do with my son? DJ's expression shifts. What the hell did you do with my son, you alien freak? He charges forward until the table no longer separates them. Fingers tighten around the gun. You shapeshift into him after you kidnap him? I know some of you have the ability to look like other people. Seen it on the news. The gun is lifted with conviction and pointed to the alien freak's head. How long have you been impersonating him? Dad, don't call me that. I'm not your father, you hear me? He presses the barrel of the gun to the alien freak's forehead hard enough to leave an imprint. Tears stream from the young man's eyes he inherited from his father. You are not my son. The words are pressed out between gnashed teeth. My son is human. Even if he was one of you, he would never tell me. He knows how I feel about this genetic reawakening bullshit. You messed up. I'm still human. I'm still me. This won't be the first time I shot an intruder. Dad, please, the gun's pulled away for a snatch of a second only to blur towards him again. Pain and light and vertigo bombard DJ's senses and he is on the floor. A thin stream of blood drips warm and thick from his mouth. Keys twist in a lock and the front door of the house is pushed open with a squeak. Dwight Jr., I'm back. Hope all your homework's done. The door closes. Just bought the new martial arts flick you like. A plastic bag rustles and keys clatter on the counter. I also picked up a little something for myself. I know we can just buy movies online and stream them, but I just don't trust. Father and son look to the right to see a woman and see a woman peep into the kitchen where Dwight Jr. left his backpack. Baby boy? They watch her walk down the hallway, not once glancing into the living room. DJ looks at his father, at the grin and hardness in his eyes, and keeps his mouth shut. DJ, I hope you're not. The woman steps into the living room and her hands fly up to her mouth as she gasps. Blue eyes widen. Dwight, what the hell are you doing? Put the gun down, now. The man sways where he stands and becomes a degree more docile. Did you know our son's been replacing one of those abominations, Annalise? He nails his glare to the thing that looks like his son and watches as the eyes they share are slowly blotted out to neon green. I knew it. Human's eyes don't do that. Where's my son? Your son is kneeling in front of you in tears because his father's pointing a gun in his head. Annalise's fingers clench in the fist. His style started doing that a few months ago. We talked about it. There's nothing wrong with him. Dwight finally rips his eyes away. Are we both looking at the same thing? You did not give birth to this. The gun barrel jabs accusingly. You shouldn't have talked about it. You should do what I'm doing now. Annalise parts her lips. Just give me the gun before you do something else you regret. She swallows and steps forward with a quivering handout. We can go fill your prescriptions after this. You were like this the last time you stopped keeping up with your doses. Don't twist this on me, Annalise. I had to decide between buying my medication and taking care of my son. The father's eyes narrow on the bleeding boy. This thing looks damn convincing, but it's not our DJ. Dwight, don't be She bites the word off. We can discuss this, all three of us, but first, you have to put the gun away. She steps forward. Just give it to me. All I wanted to do was rebuild our relationship, Dad. Mother and father look down at their kneeling son. I've seen how unhappy and depressed you've been lately. DJ's lips tremble over the words, like a cave in your chest. Neon orbs stumble over his father. Now you're hurt and you feel betrayed. By me. He squeezes his eyes shut. I didn't mean to do this to you, I swear. I just wanted us to be closer. Coming for you, DJ. His father lifts the gun and squeezes the trigger at the same time that Annalise throws herself at her son. The sound of the fired bullet gnaws at the air. For a handful of fragile moments, it's as if time stutters and gapes in naked disbelief at what it sees in itself. Then the mirror shatters and slices away back on temporal track, bleeding truth as time hurtles forward to catch up with itself. Annalise looks down at the hole in her chest, blood soaking into her blouse. She looks over at her son when she shoved him out of the way. She eases down on his side as if taking a nap. Her breath rattles as it wheezes out. Both Dwight's watch as Annalise Lucero dies. DJ glances up, eyes still charged neon. He blinks. He opens his mouth. You, the gun sings out once more. Dwight watches as the thing impersonating his son dies. Silence. Mouth gaping open, the man eventually melts down to his knees. Fingers twitch around the warm blood-warm contours of the gun. Anger dissolves into agony as the arms holding the gun flops limp. His moaning cries echo through the living room. He turns to look at the bodies. He raises the gun to the picture of himself and Annalise holding their son just after he had been born. A sudden crack of anger seizes violently across his face. He fires shots into the wall of family photographs, bullet holes tearing through smiles, memories, laughs, and embraces. He aims at the window pane Dwight Jr. painted when he was 5 and fires a bullet in it. House full of lies. Tears roll down his face, drool stretching from the corner of his lips. But I'm gonna find the truth. I'm gonna find you, son, the real you. He walks out of the house full of lies. He stops when he remembers how DJ's mouth would always pinch to the side whenever he cried. The exact same way it had before he shot him. He remembers because it's so rare that his son let anyone see him cry. Thoughts ricochet in his skull, looking for a way out. Minutes later, he goes back into the house full of lies, gun still in his hand. Thank you.
O'Brien Gunn, everyone. We have one more performer for you this evening. I just want to say we do this the first Thursday of every month, so please join us next time. But now, please welcome the wonderful Beth Davies Stofka, everyone.
That Jen did, and I'm not, this is literally my second time using a microphone. How am I doing, honey? All right?
Yeah.
Okay. Yes, I'm Beth Davies Stofka. I write for Baseball Prospectus. And Jen mentioned that I should plug the Englewood Writers Group, which meets on the first and third Wednesday of every month at the Englewood Public Library. And the reason that I am inclined to plug it is because it's where I met Jen. And it's where I met Katie. And if you had been there last night, you would have heard a very convincing story of how the group changed my life, because I was not a fiction writer until I started attending. And now I write for Baseball Prospectus. And so that's like in a year or something. So, and now I stand here before you. and I have two short pieces to share with you. I'm not a fan of trigger warnings, but I'll just mention that if you are in need of a break to get some coffee or something, my reading would be the one in which to do that. The first piece is called The Monster, And it was inspired by a waltz I did to a song called Il Mostro by a group called Ashram, and you can find that on YouTube. It's a lovely, lovely composition. And the story goes like this. Beth has died. In the attic of the old stone house, the poet sobs, tearing at the heavy rugs they had used for insulation from the wind and rain. Their laughter reverberates up the stairs while he relives the day that they lost their footing and fell as they dragged those rolled weights up to the top of the house. They had pretended to be workmen of the guild as they hammered the rugs over walls and ceiling. Hearing their laughter now, he overturns the furniture, the chairs, wardrobes, and fainting couches that were cast off with the rugs, that they rescued from the trash heap and hauled to sanctuary before they could be burned. Old costumes and toys, keepsakes of childhood, clutter the room and he kicks at them, watching feathers dislodged from hats as they drift freely through the air, not cooperating with his heavy heart. He doesn't attack the window seat. He gently covers it with her favorite pink silk, smoothing it with her soft hands and plumping the pillows in hopeless preparation for her return. An old desk sits in the front window where he writes. As children, they had played in this attic, and now in youth, they had sat together in cozy silence and dreamed of the romance that lay ahead, travel, art, love, and family. They swore to only marry a lover that loved their friendship just as well. He wrote his poems with her nearby, reading and encouraging him with a smile whenever he looked at her. In the summer, she would sit quietly with her book in her lap, enjoying the breeze from the open window and describing the birds and flowers. To her, they seemed new every day. In the winter, when the outside world fell silent with snow, she would tell him stories. He was the poet, but she was the storyteller. She took him on wonderful adventures and showed him a world filled with angels and wonders renewed. She was so sweet that he almost couldn't hear her tales of horror, of actions so brutal that they couldn't be true. It was hard to believe that such a kind face could conceal such unspeakable crimes, but it did. She spoke of them only to him, never to another. His finest poems were about her. It wasn't perceptible at first, but she began to fade. His friend and muse had been a symphony, but one day she seemed diminished, as if the woodwinds had stayed home. Her substance slowly drifted as the months passed by, and his frustration rose in proportion. Where was his muse? Where was she going? He thought only of his poetry and not of her. He didn't think to ask what was wrong. He demanded that she come back, pleaded with her while she tried to explain, and one day a violin, a slight hint of a piano in tow, was all that came to sit with him. Remembering, he snaps a chair in rage. Her mother came this morning. Meeting him in the front room, she told him that Beth had died. How? By her own hand, the woman said, anger rent by grief. Hearing this, he grew to twice his size and flew at her with one harsh word. Why? But the woman was not to be intimidated. Turning to stone, she only said that she didn't know what any of this had to do with her. I told her to get a hold of herself, she said. I told her to shape up, but she always needed something. And now she's done this to me. Her mother didn't stay long after that, and now he is in the attic shaking, tearing at the walls and kicking at reality as if it could yield kinder results. In a pause, he hears a crow, a single caw. At his desk, he looks out the window at the still day under the quiet gray sky. The leafless trees hold crows. She had often talked with them. Beth has died, he tells them. And again, one of them caws. They know, he realizes. They have come to pay their respects. Tears running down his face, his rage nearly spent, he opens the drawers of the desk and throws his poems out the window. Page upon page drifts down in a saffron fountain. A love now lost, inked into the sheets. The first crow glides without speaking to catch a poem on its back, and then the others follow, a silent line of mourners, each receiving a poem in turn, and then carrying it to safety in a place beyond the wide stone courtyard. Each crow places its poem carefully on the snow. They build a cross by the bed where the tulip bulbs lie. The last poem drifts down but is caught in a rush of air. A diving owl catches it in powerful talons and rises up to the attic window. She looks in at the poet standing there. She hands the blank page back to him, and blankly he says, "But she is dead." He looks into bright owl eyes and they remind him of the dreams to come. Travel, art, love, and family. "Finish the poem," she softly says. And then she flies to the crows to rest with them in the sanctified cross of Beth. And now this is the poem he wrote.
Come forward just a little bit. There you go.
Okay. So now I can hear my, okay.
So well, this is. You're turning away from the microphone.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, as you're reading.
Okay. All right, so the poem he wrote is called Unum Kumein Höhebug. Ross told me to mash my face into the keyboard. It invented a name, Unum Kumein Höhebug, and I wonder who he is. I believe that Unum Kumein Höhebug is mild-mannered, a Finnish accountant who summers in Spain, drinking too much wine in a plaza in Seville, while at the cafe tables, old men drink morning coffee with their brandy, while at the windows, old women do laundry, while at the dry fountain, an old homeless man sings for coffee or brandy or even laundry. Unum Kumein Höhebug knows all the stories. The children gather round him, and wine flows as he tells tall tales of giants and wizards, witches and queens, fires and forests and caves and crevasses, thick with courage and danger, heavy with sorrow. Stories that have survived their monsters for centuries, and Unum Kumein Höhebug is getting tired of keeping accounts of his morning shave, of his commute home, of the coworker who bores him, of the shit data getting tired in the hot Andalusian sun. The children say he should take a break. Come out at night. Look up at the stars. You can see a lot up there, they say. Unum Kumein Höhebug comes out to the square that night, a bottle of wine in his skinny hand. He sits in his usual spot, glasses on, slumping, craning his neck, Finnish eyes, in a Spanish sky. He sees galaxies. He sees Andromeda, naked and chained, escorted by her father and mother, waiting to be raped, waiting to be ravaged by Cetus, waiting to be punished by Poseidon for her mother's transgression. He sees Andromeda looking for Perseus, Perseus who will save her. But Perseus is falling away, as are her parents, falling away, as is Cetus, falling away. The universe is expanding, and she sees them falling away. He sees them falling away, Andromeda, chained to her rock, naked and alone. Englewood Writers Group, people.
One more time for Beth Davies Topka, everyone. And for everyone you've seen tonight, thank you all so much for coming. Like I said, we do this the first Thursday of every month. We also can't thank Punch Drunk Press enough for helping us put the show together, and Mutiny for having us. Give them a hand, please. Thank you. Now, typically we do ask for donations at the end of the show to split among the performers, and I'm still going to do that. There's the bucket. There it is. Okay. I was just going to ask you to build a money pile, but this is much better. So I'm going to set this bucket over on that table right there. If you have something to give, that would be amazing. If not, just thank you for your time, and hopefully we see you next month. Thank you.
Mutiny Transmissions is a media service that provides podcasts, video, and live shows recorded inside and outside of Mutiny Information Cafe, located at 2 South Broadway in Denver, Colorado.